Okay. Is this on? Yeah, it is. I was asked to talk about the current economic crisis, and I want to argue that you can trace it back to essentially the same principle that regulates almost all capitalist activities, which is the movements of profitability. In a way that what I talk about this morning about international trade is also a question of profitability, because relative prices determined by relative costs subject to profitability of these different productions. And now I want to argue at the macro level that profitability also regulates the movements of the economy with specific reference to the crisis, the present crisis. So, and I'm going to argue that the present crisis is just a normal event in the sense of long patterns, because it's an event that has occurred before with devastating impact, but one which is recurrent. So that's why I'm calling this the first Great Depression of the 21st century, because as I will go through, I will make the point that there have been Great Depressions in the 20th and 19th centuries on a pretty regular basis, and actually we are remarkably pretty much on schedule for this one. I don't have time to present that data of the longer-term patterns, which is very interesting in itself, but anyway, I'll make reference to it. So I'm going to talk about some historical context. I'm going to mention that I'm making an argument in which the central driver of growth is profitability, of course, subject to exports and so on, which is a modification of that, but the central driver is profitability. I'm going to talk about empirical evidence for the United States, a quick look at the world situation, and if we have time, and I don't think we will, to talk about some of the discussion about what one can do in a depression and how what we're doing now is different than what was done in the 1930s. So the first important point for me is that looking at the present depression, the mortgage crisis is the trigger. It is not the cause of the crisis. Mortgages were important, and subprime mortgages were important, but they are relatively small compared to total securitized assets. And I want to argue that the immediate cause of the crisis is the huge credit bubble which preceded it for decades. The technology bubble, the interest rate, real estate bubble, and the consumer debt bubble, all of these. But the key point, again, is that these are immediate causes. These are not fundamental causes. And the fundamental causes I'm going to come to in a second, but the second element of these immediate causes was also the undoing of regulation and the creation of new unregulated arenas. Again, this is an age-old pattern. The same thing happened in the 1930s and the 1970s, so this is not new. And it's important to understand that deregulation is not just a matter of amnesia by the state, but rather very active policies by businesses who find regulation inhibits their profitability, and they set out to lobby and threaten and, of course, bribe regulators, you know, so as to release these regulations for their great self-advantage. For me, the deeper question is, why is there a huge credit bubble in the first place? And that's a question which I will come back to in a minute. For instance, one of the arguments you hear is that the credit bubble was something that Greenspan did or some other instance of mismanagement, and had that not happened, none of these events would have happened. I want to argue just the opposite. This is a pretty normal pattern, pretty familiar pattern. And what we're experiencing, I would argue, is a structural crisis, which is part of a recurrent pattern. When we use the term Great Depression, historically speaking, and especially business historians, refer to, in the advanced world, the Great Depression of the 1840s, the Great Depression of the 1880s, the Great Depression of the 1930s. The 1970s was called the Great Stagflation, and many people now look back on it and call it a repressed Great Depression. And what is striking is about in these Great Depressions, there are two kinds of broad patterns. One is a sharp collapse, a fall off the cliff, and that happened in the 1840s and the 1930s. And then the other is a protracted decline, which takes a longer period of time, and that happened in the 1870s and 1970s. Now, I'm going to come back to what causes these sharp differences, but it's clear when you have the fall off the cliff is when the financial system collapses. We have a protracted decline, the financial system collapses, doesn't collapse, but deflates, or rather crumbles at a certain rate, but doesn't completely collapse. And that's a big difference. The Japanese example, for instance, is of the famous lost decade of the 1990s is an example of the crumbling rather than the collapse form of Great Depressions. And I think we've just entered the Great Depression of 2008. So if you thought the discussion by Niloufer was depressing, by the end of this you'll be truly depressed because we're just beginning. But the important point is the form that it takes, it depends on what we do. It's a political issue. And that's why I'm going to argue that it's actually, I would hope that it takes a long time. The reason is a sharp collapse, we're largely unprepared for the political struggles that we need to do to preserve spaces that have been won and to create and open up new spaces. But as a protracted decline, especially in the advanced world, gives room for more political activities. So the central theoretical point I want to make is that capitalist accumulation is a function of what Marx calls the rate of profit of enterprise, which is the excess of the profit rate over the interest rate. The profit rate is what businesses get from their activities. The interest rate, in effect, is their alternative, their opportunity cost, or their cost of capital, as they call it. So the difference between the two is what drives what Keynes calls the animal spirits of capitalist accumulation, the difference between the expected rate of return, the marginal efficiency of investment, and the rate of interest. But the one person who makes the greatest emphasis on this is surprisingly is Marx, who talks about this as the great driver of capitalist accumulation. And he also specifically talks about the fact that this can lead to a point where the system changes from a healthy growth to stagnation and decline, which he calls a point of absolute overaccumulation. I'm going to skip that detail, but the important point is that in the system, where it achieves a point where the profitability in real terms, net of interest, is stagnant, that's a point where events can trigger the collapse because it's a point where the system's health is fragile. Just in the same sense that a piece of news can trigger a heart attack if you have a heart disease. And so we understand the difference between the cause, which is the heart disease, and the trigger, which is a piece of news. I read of a man who won the lottery, and he had a heart attack. Now, most of us hope if we win the lottery that it'll not kill us because we're hoping that our health will be relatively good when we get the news, right? But the news can be deadly if your health is not good. So we understand the difference between a trigger and a cause. And the other thing is that a long boom, when it turns into a long downturn, and we know this now daily in the newspapers, is that all the problems that were covered up by growth and apparent inflation of asset values and profitability become exposed when that tide suddenly recedes. And this Warren Buffett's famous aphorism, you only learn who's been swimming naked when the tide goes out. Well, the tide has gone out, and we've discovered a lot of naked people on this beach. I'm going to talk about the empirical evidence primarily for the United States because it would take too long to get into the other advanced countries, but the patterns are relatively similar. The path of the general rate of profit, the path of the rate of interest, the path of the difference between the rate of profit and the rate of interest, the path of total real profits of enterprise, that is the amount of profit minus the interest equivalent, and then what happens to real wages, productivity, real incomes, household debt, and debt service ratios in the period of the so-called boom and in the period of the crisis. Well, this is the key variable that drives the system, which is the profit rate. This is subject to two kinds of patterns, the trend, the long-term pattern, and the fluctuations that take place from effective demand variations and conjunctural events. For instance, if you look here, you see a declining profitability, and yet you see this big boom that takes place, and that is, of course, the cause, the primary cause of that is the Vietnam War and the great profit-led boom that government spending and military spending induced in the U.S. economy for a while. And then you see that return back down. And what's striking to me is that the period that I'm calling the crisis of 1966 to 82, which is what we call the great stagflation of the 1970s and early 80s, was a period where you get this dramatic decline in profitability. But the period that we call the boom afterwards, the boom that has just ended a couple of years ago, that is a period where the profit rate, though it fluctuates considerably, has no trend. So the question becomes, from a perspective such as mine, how do you explain a boom if profitability, which is the driver of the system, has not expanded? I was quite surprised. I expected this data because I'd worked on this before, but I hadn't really kept track of the modern events. I was working on other things. So I was quite surprised to find the profit rate hadn't changed very much. But I realized in looking at it that the theory actually says that you should be looking at the difference between the profit rate and the interest rate. So it's interesting to look at what happened to interest rates. This is the 3-month Treasury bill rate, and you're going from 1947 to 2007, and you can see that it rose tremendously. It rose modestly up to about the 1970s, in the period of the crisis, and then it rose very sharply. Part of that is attributed to Paul Volcker, but I think that attribution is exaggerated because the dotted line here is the price of capital goods, or price index, basically, and interest rates generally rise with the price index. This is a very old pattern known as Gibson's paradox. It's called a paradox because standard theory cannot explain it. And whenever in standard theory you cannot explain something, you call it a paradox. Leontief paradox, the equity premium puzzle or paradox, Gibson's paradox. The list is actually pretty great. And so it's an interesting thing for me to try to explain the relation between the two, but I won't get into that. What is striking is that that general upward movement of price levels and interest rates is absolutely broken in the period of the boom. In the period of boom, prices continue to rise, but interest rates fall dramatically. And I'm going to show you later that they also fall dramatically in the advanced world in general. So it's not just one person sitting in a room somewhere, wherever the head of the Federal Reserve sits, actually, I don't know, but plotting the path of the interest rate. This is a movement that took place in every advanced country. And that movement is the cause of the boom. Because when you put the stagnant profit rate together with the falling interest rate, then what you get is, in this period of crisis, a rising profit rate of enterprise, or a rising difference between the profit rate and the interest rate. You can see that now when you adjust for the interest rate, the profit rate essentially falls from 1947, net of interest, down to the end of the crisis in 1982. 80s, of course, where Reagan and Thatcher come into power. And then you get this rising profitability that takes place, not so much because the profit rate rises, because the interest rate falls. And then you get the current crisis where the pattern is now reversing. This is the total amount of profit relative, net of interest. This is actually, to calculate it, you have to go and take national income accounts profits, add back the interest that corporations actually pay, and then subtract from that the interest equivalent on their capital stock to do this properly. And it's not a very complicated calculation. It's easy to do for U.S. data, but for other countries it's a little more tricky. And here you see the amount of profit begins to stagnate here in this period, in the late 1960s, and that's the period where the crisis begins. And it actually collapses down at the end of that crisis. And then you see this sharp rise in profitability, net of interest, in the period of the boom up to 2005, and now the very sharp drop. Because interest rates have bottomed out, we are in the Keynesian liquidity trap range. You cannot get any lower, or not much lower anyway. Long-term interest rates could be squeezed a little bit, but there's not much room. And the profit rate is essentially stagnant at the moment. So this is a period where the crisis has begun to unfold. And when the crisis unfolds, then patterns change. There's what I call a phase change. Here's an example. Here's another important piece of information. This is the hourly productivity of labor in the business sector in the United States and hourly real compensation, both of them indexed to 1982. And you can see that in the period of the so-called golden age, from 47 to about 66, 67, they moved together very much. And even all the way up to the mid-70s, these two variables moved together. But beginning with the Reagan-Thatcher revolution, which is a right-wing conservative revolution, and in economics, the Chicago School revolution, you see this divergence. Productivity continues to grow at a fairly healthy and historical pace, but real wages begin to fall. So that relative to productivity, real wages have grown much more slowly in the U.S. This is some interesting supporting data, which is the green line is the income of the bottom 90% of the population in real terms. And the blue line is the income of the top 1% of the population. And it's quite striking. This is a lovely graph that I saw in Jerry Epstein's PowerPoint, which I immediately stole, but then I called him for permission and he said, don't worry, I stole it from someone else, so it's okay. And it's actually originally from Saez and Piketty's paper. But it's quite striking to me that the bottom 90% basically did not have any income, real income growth in the United States, all the way from the end of the crisis, the beginning of the crisis in the 1970s up to the present, in the period of the boom. Their real incomes did not rise. But the real incomes of the top 1% rose tremendously in that period of boom. This is a picture of wages in different sectors in the non-farm private sector. You have wages in the credit industry as a whole, which is this line, in the insurance industry as a whole, and here you have other finance, which, of course, where the investment banks and so on are. And you see that up to the 1980s, these moved together. And their ratio is a little bit above one, in the beginning higher, but down here, not that much above one. Their relative wages relative to the non-farm private sector. So broadly speaking, the financial sector was not very much higher in relative wages until the 1980s. And then you see this huge change in the wages of the financial sector, of the investment banks and so on, which happened exactly during this boom. So it was a boom that was particularly beneficial, as we know, to the financial sector. This is a picture of the U.S. debt-to-income ratio. And again, you see that there wasn't much movement here in the period of the crisis, but in the boom, fueled by huge amounts of debt. Per income, or the ratio of debt to income. And this is the debt service ratio, which is much less movement. As you can see, the movement here is in between 11 and 12%, but on the order of about 12% until just in the 90s, where the debt service ratio, debt service is amortization payments and interest payments. It's what you're paying back on your loan plus the interest on your loan. So debt service becomes increasingly burdensome until it peaks. The Levy Institute has done, for instance, a lot of work on this, on the Levy model, making use of this information and deriving the patterns and examining the patterns in the U.S. economy. And this is a picture I found very surprising because I'm not sure myself what the explanation is. I understand why interest rates in the world went up together from 1960 to 1982, because that's pretty much a market-driven phenomenon, in my opinion. But it's not clear to me why all over the advanced world interest rates went down in the same way. This is the U.S. interest rate here, and this is the interest rate of U.S. trading partners, which are essentially all the major countries of the world, including some countries like Mexico and so on. and it, the weighted average of their interest rates. And it's quite interesting that they all go down together. I do not believe that this is driven by the U.S. interest rate, but that's a prejudice I generally have, not to take the U.S. as the leader of economic phenomena in the world. But anyway, that says that the boom in the rest of the world was also similarly driven by this tremendous decline in interest rates. And that's quite striking to me. Okay. So I'm going to skip this over. One of the things I want to talk about is implications for the present period. We know it has often been said that the Great Depression was recovered by a war. And what I skipped over was a detailed look at the Great Depression in which you can see that, in fact, the recovery took place well before the war. And the war, in effect, picked up on that recovery and made it a runaway boom, but the recovery was already there. But regardless of that, the war clearly had a very positive impact. And so the question is, what is it about a war that does it? And it isn't just government spending, though that's an important element. The war is really, a war is a form of social mobilization in which people commit themselves to increase production, increase employment, because soldiers are gone, other people who are normally in the unemployed are picked up, women who were previously not permitted to be in the workforce are now encouraged to be part of the workforce through huge propaganda apparatus, temporarily. Of course, when the war ended, that changed. And you see that there are two employment effects. And it's typically financed by deficit spending. And there are two employment effects that typically come from that kind of social mobilization. One is the employment from increased demand, especially employment in the defense sector. And the other is employment, direct employment by the state, which is different from employment induced by government spending. This is direct employment by the state in the armed forces, security, state, public works, and they give rise to a typical multiplier round of increased employment. So we have two types of stimulus. One is the government stimulation of demand, in which spending on goods leads to employment stimulation as a side effect, if the money is not saved or used to pay down debt. That's a very important caveat, because if you give people money and they save it, it goes back to the banks. It does not, in fact, have a multiplier effect. And the second is government stimulation of employment directly by public works, which leads to the stimulation of demand as unemployed people spend their wages. What strikes me, I alluded to it this morning, is crucial, is that the first mode of operating, which is the first mode being employment derived from increased demand, increased government spending, operates by first stimulating businesses, while the second mode operates by first stimulating employment. Now, this is an important difference. The first mode is always preferred by capital, because basically you're saying the government's going to spend money on business. Government's going to spend money on business, and businesses stimulated by this spending of money, assuming that they don't save it and don't use it to pay down debt or increase their portfolios, improve their net worth, if they respend it, then it's going to lead to increased employment. The second mode is the government directly employs people. And here, the employment effect is primary, and the stimulus on business is a secondary, because insofar as people spend that money again to buy goods and services, it goes to businesses who, if they spend the money, you'd start the multiplier chain. So the difference is that in the first case, you start the chain at the business side and hope that it trickles down, and the second, you start it at the worker side and you hope that it trickles up. And that's a big difference, in my opinion, in the two paths that we're facing now. And I should mention that obviously the first mode is preferred by capital, and the other mode, on the other hand, is correctly seen by the capitalist order as socialistic, because it's concerned more about people than it is about profits. And that's why that struggle. Now, what's interesting and striking is that Roosevelt took that second path also, and yet I don't see any discussion of that second path in the public discussion in the United States in the moment. So then, to sort of bring it to a rapid end, In the developed world, oops, I think I skipped something. Sorry, I got the order wrong. I'm going to come back to the developing world. I pasted the sheet in the wrong place. For the present period, the demands in the developed world are typically about social security, preserving retirement incomes and insurance safeguard, preserving the social safety net, especially in the United States, the laggard country of the world as far as guaranteed access to health and education, employment and retraining for those who need it, and an idea which I've had for a long time, and I realize it's probably not very popular, but the idea of possibly separating taxes out so that you know what's going for defense and what's going for social expenditure. And the reason I bring this up is that many years ago, a group of us did studies of the developed world, and we asked a simple question: who pays for the welfare state? There were many different debates about it, but we discovered something quite surprising. In almost every country of the world, the amount of money spent by the government on social expenditures, including roads for private use, parks, health, education, retraining, minimum standard living, such as welfare benefits and so on, social assistance benefits, almost all of that came from the wages of the people, of the working population themselves. And the one country where the taxes taken out of employment income and the expenditures for employees were roughly equal was Denmark and Sweden. I was surprised by that. But when you think about that, the reason they like high taxes, they tolerate high taxes, because they know it's coming back to them. The one country where this balance was not true was the United States. The United States took out much more from the incomes of employed people than it gave back. And that the difference between the two explained a substantial part of government spending on defense. So in a sense, people here also know that their taxes don't come back to them. And I've always been interested to know what would happen if people knew which part of their income was going to fight a war and which part of their income was going to pay for health, education, and social benefits of various sorts. Oops, too fast. And the last point is that if you look at in the developing world, of course, the standards, the discussions are very different. You have debate and bitter struggles about whether or not it's valid to talk about a minimum standard of provisioning, minimum consumption standard, health standard, education standards, and all of these are greatly jeopardized by the crisis because, ironically, they might be enhanced in the developed world by the crisis because of the wealth of the country, but they are actually jeopardized in the developing world, that's clear. Employment and retraining for those who need it, and as obviously emphasized here, is the elimination of gender barriers in these and other arenas of social life. All of these things are unfortunately, in my opinion, jeopardized by the crisis because, of course, it'll be the first reason not to do them. However, it doesn't mean that that will happen. And so the central question for me is, where is likely to come a response that will lead the world, so to speak, in achieving these needs? I don't see it, actually, in the developed world. But I think it is possible in those portions of the developing world which are relatively well off, and broadly speaking, in my experience, because it's a part I know the best, Latin America is well placed to make this kind of demand because it is in the middle level of the developing world, has a long history with capitalism and has a series of progressive governments coming into power now, many of whom are saying that unless they can fulfill these particular needs, they will not be able to continue in power. I've actually heard ministers say that their governments depend on their ability to fulfill these expectations, because it's no longer tolerable that they cannot. Now that Latin America has a long history of repressive, brutal regimes funded by, supported by, and often initiated by the United States. But the United States is pretty busy right now, and so it's possible that there will be room for this. And I know this is a very weak optimism, but it's certainly worth fighting for. Even if we lose, as we've lost in the past, we lay the groundwork for moving in that general direction. And insofar as some countries in Latin America can set this, or some countries in the world can set this as a standard, we get the hope to continue fighting. Thank you.
Anwar, I just wanted to, what is, you know, in the case of the long trend in interest rates, can you please elaborate about what, at least in the U.S., right? I know you can't explain why the other countries are doing the same thing, but what would be the political and economic processes why the interest rates are going down for such a long time? Yeah?
Sir, I think this particular crisis is very different from the earlier crisis which you have mentioned in terms of this whole financial thing, the stock market led boom, the flow of finance capital, and you know, capitalism has changed, has evolved over time and has changed, and now today the kind of capitalism we see, it is very different from the past. So that way, is it really comparable with the crisis? I mean, there are some similarities, but it is very different also in some terms as compared to crisis of 1840s or 80s or 1930s or oil price shock, etc.
This is really just more of a data or definitional question. What are non-financial corporations in your data there? Is GM non-financial? Is GE non-financial? Are you separating out their branches that are financial corporations when you use the profit data? Because it seems like if you're not, then maybe you don't want to subtract interest, because interest could be the main source of their profit. And if it's the main source, then you subtract it out. Of course, profits are going to look a lot lower after you do that.
I think developing countries are affected by the crisis because of two major reasons. One is through the global channels, global financial crisis, you know, exports and financial sector and exchange rate and things like that. And on the other hand, inadequacies of the government or inadequacies of the domestic economies in terms of providing them, providing their workers social protection, human development, education, health, and so on and so forth. The failure in that area. And also non-inclusive nature of development, you know, dependence on exports, for example, for economic growth, those kind of things. So the implications for developing countries could also be that they have to change the development path to make it, apart from, of course, providing social protection, etc., to make it stronger and protect itself for future crises like this, if not for their own development goals.
Let me start with the first Butch's question about why did the interest rate fall for such a long time. I tend to be extremely resistant to the idea that the state determines key variables, but I have to say in this case, the evidence seems to point towards the idea that there was a strong intervention in the United States to lower interest rates and to do so to, in effect, make capital cheap for all kinds of credit-based activities, including for the profitability of the financial sector, because this interest rate is the rate at which, in effect, the cost of capital for all capital, and obviously it makes profitability higher. One of the people who makes this argument is George Soros in his book, The Crisis of 2008, just recently came out, who talks very much in terms of the concrete patterns and mechanism. But it's something that I need to study more, and here's the reason why I hesitate to do this. If you look in among economic traditions, there are not very many theories of the interest rate. There is the neoclassical theory of the interest rate, which is in the bottom end tied ultimately to profitability, the marginal product of capital. And then there are Keynesian theories where the dominant argument is the interest rate is essentially set by the state. It's a conventional rate anyway, and the state can affect the convention, and the marginal product of capital is tied to it. Now, that's just kind of schematic of the two poles, but I think that's broadly descriptive of that. There's a lovely book by Carlo Panico called The Theory of Interest in Marx and Keynes or something like that, which is a very detailed study of the theories of interest rates. And when you get to Marx, people essentially, as Panico points out, Marx appears to be on both sides of the argument, so it's not clear where that is. And so I became very interested in developing an alternate theory of the interest rate. I won't go into all of that, but broadly the idea is the following. We forget that the interest rate that banks offer is the source of their profitability. They're capitalist enterprises like every other enterprise. So the interest rate has to be, is the price of their product, so to speak. In Marxian terms, it's their price of production. And if there's profit rate equalization, which I believe there is, and that's data which I didn't present here, but I can, then the interest rate has to be such as to give banks a roughly normal profit rate if they're exposed to competition. And competition meaning if capital can go from banking to other sectors. And banks, like any other enterprise, make money and they have to put their money somewhere. And they go to wherever it's highest, like every enterprise. So if that's the case, then the interest rate, the market interest rate, so to speak, is determined by the same principles as any price, profit rate equalization. So then what would account from that theoretical point of view for this big drop in the interest rate? And what would account for that across the whole world is great innovation in the ability to create and offer credit. In other words, a technological revolution in the cost of production of banking. Now, there is considerable evidence that the period of the 80s and 90s was a period of great technological revolution in banking, for obvious reasons, computers and access to credit of that sort. So that's one element. Now, that does not preclude the possibility that the state can intervene. Obviously, the price of houses has a market determination, yet if you're in New York City and lucky enough to be living in a rent-stabilized apartment, then you know that the state can also have an impact, or rules can have an impact on the price. And we understand that. Exchange rates, the same thing. So my first concern is, what's the theory of the interest rate at the market level? And the second is, how do you know whether the interest rate you observe deviates from that? And that is research I'm literally undertaking now by looking at interest rates in financial and non-financial sectors. Looking at profit rates in financial and non-financial sectors. And the trends are broadly consistent with the idea of innovation, though individual movements like the Volcker shock or Greenspan's interventions to lower the interest rate or recent ones are clearly there. So that's why I'm a little hesitant to answer, because I don't have the answer yet. I'm working on it. But my general inclination is to first have the theory of the interest rate in hand. And what I like about the idea of interest rate determined by profitability is the same principle as what determines accumulation, the same principle as exchange rates and so on. So it's a very simple principle that you can apply again and again. The book I'm working on this year while I'm in seclusion is precisely to put all these ideas together in one place with all the empirical evidence and the alternate theories and so on, so that you can see that this only takes a few principles to explain a wide, or at least it's possible to explain a wide variety of phenomena with a few principles. And I believe this has a lot of relevance to Keynesian arguments, and especially to Keynes's own arguments, which are somewhat different than the post-Keynesian tradition. So Randy's question was non-financial corporations. I'm using the national income and product account definition of non-financial corporations as in the BEA definition. And that generally, if I remember correctly, separates out arms of companies so that General Motors finance division would be in the financial part, and General Motors itself, the production division, would be in the production part. I believe that's correct. But obviously, banks are in the financial part, insurance companies, financial part, and then different the gray areas where individual firms have both. But I'm pretty sure they separate them out that way. But you raised another important, interesting point. Should you subtract the interest rate from the profits of banks? And I would argue you should, provided you subtract the right interest rate. You can't subtract the interest rate that banks charge for credit from their profit, because it is, in fact, their cost, their price of production, but you can subtract their in rate, that is the three-month T-bill, which is a proxy for the sort of liquid financial asset rate, because that would give the profit rate above their profit rate above the cost of capital. And a theory of banking sort of built along those lines. It's clear it's in Keynes very clearly. It's in Hicks and so on. So I think that's a consistent way to go. But I did take out the non-financial corporations precisely for this fear of double counting, and also because I'm still working on the financial part of the story. There was a question about, oh yeah, this crisis is different from past ones. Well, yes, I mean, sure, it's like saying this river is different and you can't step in the same river twice, but you can certainly drown in the same river twice, and so the important thing is it's still a river. It is different, but the question I would ask is, has modern capitalism overthrown the central guiding principle of capitalism, which is profit determination? And I would argue not at all. If anything, profit rules our lives more now than it did in the past. It's a more perfect principle in the sense that we have no escapes left from it, and no parts of the world, by the way, which are left outside of it anymore. So I would argue that, in fact, the profit motive is still the driving central principle, which is why I referred to it. And as far as the question of whether or not the phenomena are different, I recently read this wonderful book by John Kenneth Galbraith called The Great Crash. I recommend it to everybody. It's a fast read. It's very exciting, kind of scary, but he writes so beautifully. There's nothing like that style that in the old economics tradition of institutionist, historical, and he makes the point that the crisis of the 30s was based on leverage, on the equivalent of hedge funds, which were called in those days investment trusts, real estate speculation. Florida was a big real estate speculation enterprise, and he details all these profits which were done exactly, extremely similar to what we see today, including concentration, centralization, and banking. And at the end, after he discusses the great crash, he's a historian, he writes this in 1955, he says, well, now all is said and done. We had this tremendous excesses. We had regulation which didn't do his job. We had financial speculation. We had leverage. We had real estate speculation and a technological boom, all of these factors and collapse. And now we put in regulations, or we should. Will it hold? Will these regulations continue? And he says, as a social scientist and as an economist, I would like to say yes, but as a historian, I have to say probably not, because it's happened before. Because when profitability gets inhibited by the regulation, businesses start to figure out ways to get around it, either by innovations or by getting legislators to overturn the regulations. And that history is well known in the 70s and 80s and 90s, the overturn of one banking regulation after another. So I would argue that this is actually what we're seeing today is very similar as in the past, except that the global reach is different. There is no part of the world now which is outside of capitalism. And there were periods in the Great Depression where developed countries actually did relatively better because they got hurt less. But I think that period is over. Developing countries are going to get hurt more in this round. And how we react to that is very crucial, but that's because we're tied in to the capitalist system. And so that leads me to the last question, I think it was Indira's question. Is the crisis in developing countries due to the export fall off and the inadequacies of the state and the inclusive, non-inclusive nature of development? Yes, I would certainly say all of those things, but for me, I read them differently. All of these are characteristic features of capitalist development. What happened in the last three decades of development was that it was development based on market and profitability. That's what we were forced to do, not even asked, forced to do. We were told this is the way to go, export-led growth, forget about import substitution, forget about dealing with people on the bottom, growth will lift them, lift that tide. So the inadequacies of the state were, in fact, from our point of view, inadequacies. From the point of view of the capitalist plan, so to speak, they were adequacies. Step away and let the market do its job. Well, the market has done its job, and it has produced a characteristic response, which it has done many times before. And unfortunately, unless things change radically in the next 50 or 60 years, it will do it again. Galbraith's pessimism is an important thing to keep in mind. As a social activist, as a theorist, as an economist, I would like to say this is the last time, never again. But as a historian, I doubt that that is an easy thing to say. And I would dearly, dearly hope to be completely wrong about that. Thank you.
Thank you for your presentation, Anwar. I'd like to ask you, what do you think of a statement that many developing countries have not been affected by the crisis because they are not well integrated in the international economy?
Anwar, I also believe, like you, that the system is one that is profit-driven. And I also believe that there are varieties of Marxism, there are varieties of capitalism, some of which are more brutal than others. But at the same time, I mean, in light of also sort of what I was talking about in the last session, I don't think any country is innocent or purely compassionate in the way it practices its capitalism, because you could be a country that is very egalitarian. You could have zero wage differentials, let's say, between men and women, but your economy is permeated by prices of by wages of discrimination simply because of what you are importing. So in that sense, no economy is innocent, I would say. So that's one statement. And the other statement I'm making is that there are more and less brutal versions of capitalism, but those have to be practiced at the level of the world economy. So one of the things that we always sort of always ask ourselves, both keeping realism in terms of historical patterns, but also having a vision of a world and dreaming about another world that we truly do believe is possible, what are the things that we should be advocating? And sometimes we should be advocating things that are entirely unrealistic. What are the things that we should be advocating as citizens, as economists? Bearing in mind all these other things that I said. What is to be done, brother?
Other questions? Well, let me take those two. Let me start with the notion that developing countries are going to be not affected by the crisis because they were, as it used to be called, decoupled. I was reading George Soros's book, and he talks about the fact that he believed that argument when it was given, and he didn't just believe it. He made a huge bet on the fact that the crisis, which he was predicting, he'd been writing about for several years. He said, it's coming, you know, 2008, 2009, I don't know, but I'm willing to put several hundred billion dollars behind this prediction. And so he sold short stocks and assets in the developed capitalist countries, but he was long in India and China. And he said the money he made in the developed world, he lost in the developing world and more. He got killed because, to his surprise, it turned out that the developing world was not decoupled from the center. Now, I must say that I unfortunately did expect the developing world to fall, and I don't have a single dollar to came as profit from that prediction, but I did make it, which is that it's obvious that the boom in the countries that we're talking of as the great successes, India, China, Asia, in Latin America, the booms in Chile and Brazil and Argentina were linked to the development of the great bubble in the world market, the great financial speculative bubble. We at the Levy and the macro modeling group had been talking about this for quite some time, and so it was not a surprise for me that the going down of the center would take everybody else down, and because of the multiplier effect works in both directions, the collapse and contraction of credit was going to have a massive impact, at least in the short run, in countries like India and China. And I think the problem where I'm, Sorrell says that he thinks things are going to turn around by 2010. I don't think so. Now, I concede that he knows a whole lot more about the details than I do. So I look at these broad general patterns. But the patterns tell you a different story, I think, which is that in order for the system to recover, two things have to happen from its point of view. Forget about people and poverty and gender. The system is largely indifferent to that, except so far as we can make it pay attention. But what is crucial is profitability of the financial sector and profitability of corporations in general. And there is a huge toxic mass of financial assets and real assets which has to be digested by the system before its appetite improves. And we know that in the case of Japan, we have an instance in front of us that is very revealing. You can either allow that stuff to just die and take your chances that it's going to spread through the economy but not kill everything, or you allow it to deflate slowly by keeping these so-called zombie banks and zombie enterprises alive. And I'm totally in favor of the second option, because that preserves jobs and it preserves political space to fight for fundamental changes so that the recovery will not be on the same terms as the previous one. Now, in the developing world, that problem is different, because I don't know, I doubt very much that India and China are going to be bouncing back because of their internal markets, at least under the present policies of the states in those countries. It's conceivable to me that China and perhaps even India would suddenly turn around and say, to hell with being a capitalist country, we're going to use the world market as a resource, but we're now confident enough or determined enough that we're going to develop internally, do import substitution, and we have to do employment of last resort, and we have to do education following Cuba's example, and healthcare, and we're going to make this central. It can be done, or at least substantial change can be done, but I don't see any political discussion of this. And so my pessimism does not come from the objective impossibility, but the fact that the political arena doesn't discuss it. And therefore, I take Niloufer's central point that it's our job to be unrealistic. There's nothing worse than being realistic, because nothing good comes from being realistic at this domain. Yes, you don't want to jump off a cliff because gravity is a realistic phenomenon, but you don't want to say that you can never jump off a cliff. You want to develop wings. So you have to figure out, how do we put into the discussion, and people are doing it all over the world, by demanding that the old answers not be the ones that we accept, that the old terms of the discussion be not acceptable. And yes, when we broaden the terms, we have many things we ourselves don't know. But knowing that already gives us an advantage over those people who narrow the terms and don't know what they don't know, don't even know how to ask. So I think it is very important to push things like universal health care, universal education, and universal employment, recognizing that these can be very differentially accepted and absorbed in different countries. And also, as tying back to the themes earlier, that trade has to be subordinate to development, and the market has to be subordinate to social goals. Now, these are very big things to say, but they're not new. They've been around as long as capitalism is around, and they periodically get revived. It's our chance to make one or two steps, maybe 10 steps in that same direction, so that when the recovery comes, and it will come, in my opinion, it'll be on different terms. The risk there is that as we advance these ideas, the forces of the right are also organized to force a different movement. And the history of, I come from Pakistan, so you know it's pretty hard to see it, think of a period that wasn't a military dictatorship or close or worse than a military dictatorship, because democracy frequently functions worse. malfunctions often enough worse. So it's hard to say that, you know, you can say this and you expect it to happen. You can say only that you have to fight for it. And it's quite likely that in many parts of the world you'll get the coups that you're beginning to see in Honduras now. That's a normal way. They will not solve the problem. And I think this time, actually, the developed world is in the same trap as it was in the 30s. It's so absorbed with its own crisis, it may not be able to afford to keep these regimes alive. Why does Obama not rush to Honduras with military arms and so on? He knows perfectly well if he starts this spark, it's going to spread across Latin America, and the U.S. can't afford it. Defense expenditures are unproductive expenditures. They're very expensive. And so that's my hope. My hope that they will understand that they need to accept a fundamental series of changes, which is actually going to be easier to absorb than to do the repression, which has been the policies in the past. And in that sense, Obama is a very good sign, because I think he's smart enough to see this, which was clear that Bush was not. So...